Hey, it is June 18th, 1999, and I am Luann Johnson. I am interviewing Dr. Ghiami, who is originally from Iran, and we are at the Barnes & Noble Cafe in Bowling Green, Kentucky, so there will be considerable background noise, cappuccino making, possibly phone calls, and loudspeaker announcements. Thank you for coming this afternoon, Dr. Ghiami.
You are very welcome.
I just want to start out to see how did you arrive in Bowling Green?
Well, initially, back in 1987, I decided to find a place to practice chiropractic. And my in-laws at that time, and still at present time, they reside in North Carolina. And I was living in Davenport, Iowa, and many times we would go to visit them in North Carolina, and Kentucky always was a good halfway to stay, to rest, to make the second part of the trip. And I always enjoyed driving through Kentucky, because it was so much different than Midwest, you know, with the mountains and the scenery. I really like this place. So after I thought at, you know, long time I thought, you know, about moving and practicing chiropractic. I used to teach at that time. I talked to my wife and we decided to move from Davenport, Iowa, and perhaps either go to live in North Carolina or use a place that is halfway between my family and her family. And since we both really like Kentucky, so this was basically the first choice. And what I decided to do at that point, since we didn't know anybody in Kentucky, Yvonne and I, we decided to make a few trips to different cities in Kentucky to see what area we liked the most. So one of our primary objectives was we wanted it to be a city that is not too big, and at the same time, the city that it will have university, so that way my kids would not have to leave after they finish high school if they chose not to. So we made a target plan of traveling to Richmond, Kentucky, Bowling Green, Murray, Kentucky, and of course we drove through Lexington, and I kind of like Lexington. So we went and we visited Owensboro, we visited, I guess, Richmond, and when we came to Bowling Green, this is very funny, I believe in destiny, by the way. It was late in the afternoon, it was during the month of March, and it was getting close to get dark, and we pulled through the parkway. And we came through 31 bypass, and the kids, they were very young. They had three daughters at that time. Two of them, they were in diapers, and the other one was, I guess, probably 4 year, 5 year old. And we pulled on 31 bypass. At that time, I believe there was a fast food seafood place, Captain D. And I pulled in the parking lot, and there was this older lady with her daughter. They parked next to our car, and the first thing they said was, "Oh, you're from Iowa?" And I said, "Yes." Of course, they looked at the plate and license plate, and they knew we were from Iowa. And they start talking as to why are you here, what brought you here. And I told them that I was a chiropractor, and I was trying to see what area of the state I would like to go ahead and start a practice. I remember the lady, the older lady, she was from Glasgow, Bowling Green, and the daughter was from living in Glasgow at that time. And they started saying, "Oh, we'd love to have you here, we need a good chiropractor." And the mother said, "We need you to come to Bowling Green and start a practice here." And the daughter said, "No, come to Glasgow." And I mean, they were bargaining as to who wants to get, you know, me and my family to move to their town. went, we ordered the food, they came, the food, and they came, they sat next to us, and they were very friendly, very nice people. And so I asked, you know, where we can stay around here, and those days we didn't have all these hotels that you see now. And I guess one of those ladies said, you know, if you go by I-65, there is Ramada Inn, there is a couple of other hotels. So we ate the dinner, and then we drove, and you know, I saw at that time the Super 8 Motel, you know, and I said, well, let's go see if they have any vacancies. So we went there, and the receptionist's name, it was Fred, I remember up to even to this day. And so we checked in to see if they had a room, and Fred asked me, you know, if I was traveling through the town. I said, no, as a matter of fact, I'm a chiropractor. I'm checking different towns to see what I like to practice. And Fred said, oh, great, we need you here. My wife needs chiropractic work, you know, and, you know, when are you going to open your practice? I said, I'm not opening. I'm just driving through the town to see if I like it here. So we checked in the hotel, and that next morning I got up, went downstairs to have a cup of coffee. I walked outside. You have to understand, this is early part of March. Early part of March in Iowa is freezing cold. And here, grass was green, birds, they were singing, and it was a sunny, nice day. In, I guess, mid-60s, you know, it was a beautiful day. And I walked in the parking lot, and I was looking at I-65. And I had at that time such a peaceful feeling that something or somebody was telling me this is where the home is going to be. It's hard to explain. I walked back, I went upstairs, and I told my wife, this is it. And she said, you know what, I explained, you know, with my feeling and what I felt. She said, you know, I feel about the same. So the next day, we checked out, we left Bowling Green. I didn't even check to see where the university is or how big it is or try to drive different parts of town to see if I really like it or not. And as a matter of fact, I was taking a whole week off to do, you know, to go travel different cities, excuse me, to see which city I like. I guess Bowling Green was the third city I drove. And we turned around, we went back to Davenport, and the following week I gave my resignation to school. My wife was working at Hormel as a microbiologist, and she gave her resignation, and we moved to Bowling Green without knowing anybody, you know, new town. And that's how we ended up in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
And that was in the 80s?
That was in 1987.
And
April of 1987.
Okay. So how long have you been in chiropractic?
I graduated in 1984.
Okay.
So 84, 99.
Yeah. So you were teaching chiropractic?
I was doing a program called Clinic Teaching Residency that part of that, you know, doing different residency program was also one of my responsibility was to teach and coordinate a class that it was named Clinic Research Conference Class. And so, you know, I was giving the responsibility of that class. And when I gave my, you know, resignation, said, you know, I'm going to leave, they didn't want me to leave because they liked what I was doing at the school. So, but I guess destiny brought me to Bowling Green. Yes, I was teaching prior to coming here.
So this was your first practice, your first business?
First, you know, practice as far as, you know, having my own office. You know, when I was working at the Palmer College of Chiropractic, one of my responsibility also was I was clinic unit director, and I was supervising and overseeing the care of patients that they were coming to that clinic. They had a number of students assigned to different unit directors, and I was one of those unit directors.
Okay. Now, you mentioned your wife's family lives in North Carolina, and your family lives in Iowa?
My family, most of them in Iowa at that time. Now they have moved to Kentucky as well.
Okay. Now, what originally brought everyone over from Iran?
Well, at initially, my oldest brother was going to school here, graduate school, and my parents, they thought, you know, that since he's here by himself alone, it would be nice if I come and go to school, and at the same time, you know, I would be here with my brother, so that way he won't feel homesick. So that's when I finished high school, then I came here as a student.
Where was that at?
That was, initially I went to California, and then my brother, you know, transferred, you know, actually went from California to Babson College in Massachusetts. And so when he moved, I made a move and I went with him to Massachusetts. And that was where I met my wife. And then we got married. We were both pre-med students.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So what was your first experience moving to the States? Was that something you had always known you wanted to do, or did it just happen?
Actually, it just happened, you know. And of course, you have to realize at that time, back in 1970s, early 70s, there were a lot of Americans living in Iran. And so, you know, I was exposed to American culture and American people where I used to live. We were using in the nice, affluent neighborhood. So, you know, I was exposed to a lot of, you know, foreigners. And as far as, you know, the city of Tehran is concerned, very modernized city back those days. One of the things was when I came to the United States, actually, there was nothing actually different here as opposed to Tehran. I remember when I came to the United States, when we had to call to talk to my parents, we had to call through overseas operator, dial 011, I guess, or 00, I can't remember. This has been a long time ago. And go through the operator in order to call, have the international operator dial the number in Tehran. Whereas in Tehran, you could dial it directly without even going through the operator. You could have even dialed it through calling outside in the street directly overseas. So actually over there, in that perspective, it was more modernized because everything was happening fresh. So we got the best of the technology because they had the oil money and they were flooding with all the new technology. Whereas when we came here, you know, I had to dial through the operator. Another thing also, it was exciting, you know, like the cars we would drive was much nicer than the car they were driving here. Over there, a lot of BMW, Volvo, Mercedes, you know, nice car. And then you would come here, a lot of beat up car, you know, Volkswagen, you know, and so it was basically not a big cultural shock as far as going from a third world country, let's say, to some place that is technologically above everybody else. Basically, as far as lifestyle, technology, was pretty much we had the same thing we had here.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you had been exposed a lot to American culture already, but what are some of the big differences that you noticed settling down in America culturally?
Well, you know, one thing is, you know, in Iran, you know, people, family members are much more closer together. And also friendship means a whole lot more than what it is here. For example, over there, it would not be unusual for you to do anything you can to help a friend and help another, either your friend, neighbor, family member, or even a stranger. I remember there were times that I would see a German tourist or, you know, American tourist, and they would ask for a direction, and I knew where it was, and I would say, okay, I'll take you, and I would take half hour of my time to go show where they needed it to be. Whereas here, you don't see it as much. In a smaller city, it's true. You see some of that, but it's not as close-knit as you see them. Another difference in culture is you know, the values are different there. You know, the, especially something that I noticed, and to this day it really bothers me. In Iran, you know, they credit a person based on their brain, based on their character, based on the person they were. And they did not use a woman as a sex object like you see it here. Here they want to sell a bubble gum, you see a woman in bikini. They want to sell a tire, you see a woman in bikini sitting on top of the tire. They want to sell a furniture, you see a woman in a bikini laying on a piece of furniture. And over there it wasn't like that. You know, most of the time you would look at the woman as they could be your sister, or they could be your mother, or they could be your, you know, neighbor. So there was more respect for the person rather than the physique, you know. And that was some of the factor that it was, you know, it's still to this day, I believe, it's a major difference. Friendship is in a deeper sense. Family, they stick together very closely. And, you know, they value you based on who you are, on your intellect rather than your body or rather than what you drive. So, you know, I guess, you know, less materialistic there than it is over here.
Okay. Kind of a good segue into values and ethics. But as far as like, religious systems or philosophical systems, what were you raised with? And
I was raised as in a Muslim family. But my mom or dad, they were not practicing, you know. You know, we were in a family, you know, we were, as a matter of fact, I'll tell you this background setting. In the street we used to live, we had three families that they were opposite of our house, and they were of Jewish religion. And two houses down from them, there was a, you know, a family that they were Assyrian, which are Christian, or, you know, Eastern Christians, you know. And, you know, we would visit them, they would come visit us, and we really didn't think of them as they are better, they are worse, or we never were taught you need to go and impose your religion on the other people's belief system in order to gain, you know, I don't know, brownie points or you go to heaven, whatever. We were told you will be judged based on your action, and if you are a good person, that reflects on others, and you don't need to use religious as a means of controlling or, you know, using it to influence or, you know, cheat other people. So in that sense, you know, it was more of the fact that, you know, you be good, you live an exemplary life, and that's what God wants every person to do. Help the neighbor, help the friend, be respectful to one another, respectful to the parents, help the orphans, help the needy people, you know, be respectful to the woman, be respectful to the, you know, youngsters, live an exemplary life. And these are all the commonality most religion they teach. As a matter of fact, there was no conflict or any friction, you know. I mean, we looked at them as our best friend, best buddy. And part of the Islamic religion says, you know, Judaism, Christianity, they were all true religion. And one can, being a Muslim, cannot set themselves above the rest of the, you know, those people. In other words, you know, to be a good Muslim, you have to be a good Jew and a good Christian also. So that was the idea that I was brought up with. And I'm glad I did, because it gave me a diversity and understanding, and knowing that, you know, you're just like everybody else, because you are so-called Jews, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, whatever, that doesn't make you any better than your next door neighbor. And, you know, you need to help people regardless of their color, their race, their belief system. And when you go back to the, even from religious perspective, we all originated from Adam and Eve. So in a sense, we are a big family of diverse ideology, which it makes it not any better than the other group.
So how have you integrated that in your life here in Bowling Green or in America?
Well, United States, you know, has such a large group of different ethnicity and religious. You know, for example, in the United States, I believe at least there are probably 7-8 Muslim, you know, living, you know, citizen of this country, and probably the same number in Jewish faith. So it really made me to be, if anything, maybe a little bit more understandable, making me a little bit more appreciative of the value system. I taught not to judge them because, you know, people, they are not, you know, same sex as I am, you know, like you would see here. Here sometimes you see the Catholic thing, Orthodox would not go to heaven. You know, the Nazarene believes they are the only one, they go to heaven. You know, Methodists believe they are the one. That's something, you know, I'm glad, you know, I wasn't taught, and I was taught you would be judged on your action regardless of who you are. Because after all, you can put a front and fake it, but inside you, he knows, the God will know who you are. And when the day comes, you'll be judged on that, not what front you put on or what you preach and then turn around and did something totally opposite when nobody was looking. So it has really helped me to realize, you know, if anything, I'm the one I need to change for betterment. And if I do a good job, hopefully people will, you know, respect me for who I am, not a brand of religion that I carry with myself.
So have you found a community to worship with here in Bowling Green?
Well, one thing is my philosophy, that's part of the philosophy. You don't need to belong to a, you know, square footage. You don't need to be under the roof in order to worship God. You can do it every second, no matter what place you are. You know, at least, you know, I'm not exaggerating, but 20, 30 times a day, I always thank God. Anytime a patient comes see me and I notice they are getting better, I always give the credit to him because I'm only an instrument. He's the healer, and through, you know, his healing, I'm able to get patient well. So, you know, you really, you know, to say you definitely need to have a building or beautiful $2 million church or mosque or synagogue, to me, it doesn't make sense. I prefer that money be used for the needy homeless family, to build them homes so they won't have to sleep under the bridge, than having a fancy, glamorous building to worship. You know, the church should be inside your heart. Mosque should be inside your heart. Synagogue should be inside your heart. Temple should be inside your heart. So you really don't need to have a specific building once a week for 20 minutes to feel like you are a good person. You have to live with that philosophy every second of your life.
Well, are there certain celebrations or traditions, either religious or just secular, that you maintain with your family here?
As far as religious, none, but, you know, I celebrate Persian New Year every year, and I have taught my wife, she's an American, you know, born and raised here, maybe fourth, fifth generation American. I celebrate the Persian New Year, and I teach my kid because it's first day of spring, and it's a new beginning. It's the time that the plants start to grow back from the deep sleep they were in winter month. And you know, I remember as a child when we were, you know, celebrating the Persian New Year, one of the things we used to do, put on new clothes, you know, sit on the table prior to the time that the beginning first, you know, for the time would change and would be the first day of the spring. We will sit, we will talk, we would get up and, you know, congratulate each other for, you know, having the opportunity to live to see one more year to come, you know. And then our mother and father, they used to give us, you know, similar to gift like you do here for Christmas. You know, there was a monastery. They will give you money. And then we will go on and we had 13 days of holiday. School would be closed, but the official government would be closed 5 days. And what we would do, we would start from the oldest member of the family to go visit them, to pay our respect, wish them a healthy, happy, prosperous year. And we will go visit during these, you know, 13 days. And they will come visit us. And it was a hierarchy of who sits first day and gets the visitor. And then as you start getting to the younger group, then you would be on the later days because your job was to go see the elders. And that was pretty neat because it taught us to respect older people. It taught us to respect our grandparents, aunts, uncles, because, you know, we were there because of them. And it was very delightful, the experience, to sit there as a family, talk and witness that, you know, they happened to live also and share some of their experience with us. Very nice. That's the only holiday that I celebrate. And most Iranian, now that they live in United States, they still celebrate that Persian New Year, which is called Nowruz.
Nowruz?
New Days.
Okay. And what kind of preparation goes into it?
Well, you know, one of the few things, you know, a few days before the New Year, usually they clean the house, similar to a spring cleaning we have here. Drapes have to go to dry cleaner, windows needs to be washed. Not that they don't do it all year, but it's a special activity goes on. And then, you know, they will grow wheat, you know, and, you know, as a symbol of new life. They will put ribbon around it, the wheat will be soaked on a plate, and it starts to sprout, and, you know, it's a symbol of life. They will have goldfish on the table, and they will have 7 different things that starts with the letter C in Farsi, symbolizing, you know, different things like garlic, like apple, vinegar, coin, and wheat that is growing, and eggs that it was colored similar to Easter egg decoration, and the sumac, you know, and these, they all represent a different meaning of life. So they will have these, they would be on a table, and then on the time that the time will change, you know, exactly, then, you know, we will be sitting on the table, and depending on who's, you know, followed what faith, Christian, they will have Bible on the table. Jews, they had, you know, Torah, you know, Muslim, they had Quran, Zoroastrian, they had, you know, Avesta, it's their holy book. And they, you know, it was a New Year for everybody of different faith. It wasn't like here New Year is more of Christian New Year. You know, it was the New Year that it included all faiths. It was very nice. I still, you know, that's one of the few things that I miss, because over there, when you go out there, you see everybody wearing suit, nice clothes. They get into their car to go visit, you know, their family and member. So you were with the flow of, you know, what everybody else was doing. Whereas here, it's not the same, because, you know, in Bowling Green, there are not that many Iranian family anyway.
So is there a history behind the Persian New Year, or has it gone on for...
Oh, yeah, this has been gone for thousands of years, you know, and it goes back to the time that Persia, Egypt, and maybe Greece was the only civilization there was. I don't remember now the whole story of how it started, but it's been something that it has survived through many turmoil in Iran during the conquer of, you know, Alexander, you know, other conqueror, you know, still, you know, people, they kept that culture. Even to this day, Iranian that they are in exile in United States, they still do that.
Are there songs or decorations or things that...
Decoration, no song, but decoration, and just visiting family, renewing the friendship, you know, and, you know, taking time to, you know, smell the roses, so to speak, you know.
So this is something that you've taught your children to
Yes,
celebrate?
You know, and they, you know, we celebrate Christmas, we also celebrate the Persian New Year. You know, I think the more kids are exposed to this type of diversity, it's better, because that way they realize, you know, they have to respect others, and they have, you know, that way they realize they are, you know, other people that are just as important. They have feeling, they have celebration, they have, you know, activity that would be just as nice, and I think it would be important for them to learn and become curious enough to not only learn but also be respectful. So when they see, you know, somebody, you know, in Africa is celebrating and doing some sort of celebration that is not what we are used to, they won't have to look down and say, you know, what is this, you know. So they realize, hey, every culture, they have their own things. In our eyes, to our eyes, it may not look kosher, but, you know, to their eyes, that's part of the culture. We need to respect it.
Try to gather my thoughts. So, do you still have a considerable number of family back in Iran?
Close family, no. You know, and you have to realize I've been in the United States since 1976. And that's most of my life I've been here. And, you know, lost most of them, you know, the elder people, they have passed away, they are dead now. And the younger one that they were born after I came here, they wouldn't know me. And there are still some left, but most of the people in my family after revolution or prior to that, they, you know, immigrated to Europe, United States, Canada, you know, Australia maybe, you know, a few, but, you know, very few they are back there.
So what caused your parents to decide to move here permanently?
Well, my mom moved because all of my brothers, we are here. But my father passed away back in 1982, so if he was alive, he would have been here with us.
Mm-hmm. So do you plan on visiting or returning?
No, because, you know, I tell you what, I, 2 years ago, or maybe 3 years ago, anyway, 2 or 3 years ago, I went back to Iran for 4 days. Because I couldn't close the office, and I wasn't sure, you know, if I should go there, you know, and so I decided, you know, to go and see what's going on, and I went, and it was funny, when I went there, I felt like I'm in a foreign land, you know, what it was home past when I was young, it no longer felt like home to me, you know, I was missing here, and, you know, everybody looked to me like foreigner, you know, and so, you know, I didn't, you know, I didn't have the feeling. I was told by, you know, some of the people that I know that they were Iranian and or other nationalities, you know, they told me when they went back to their homeland, it didn't feel like home. And some of them, they were disappointed with changes. So when I went back, you know, I was, you know, it was different. Part of the fact was most of the people I knew, friends, they were all gone, you know, either, you know, to different city or different country. Most of the, you know, older people that I recall, they were dead, you know, and so, you know, I walked in a place that, you know, I didn't know that many people. The culture was different for me. I wasn't used to it. And therefore, you know, when I came back after 4 days, it was kind of good because it made my soul at rest that, you know, what I remember from home back days, those days, you know, it was a good memory, but, you know, life goes on. And to me, Bowling Green is home, you know, and although I have traveled many states, I lived in California, I lived in Massachusetts, I lived in Iowa, but Bowling Green is home. You know, this is home.
I'm going to flip the tape over, and I have a few more questions. Okay, this is side two. So are there things from, or memories from your childhood, or foods from your childhood that you miss or that you maintain while you're living here?
Well, I make a lot of the Persian foods here, and there is a lot of Persian restaurants, you know, in the United States, especially when you go to the states that there are large Iranian community, like California, and Texas, Washington, D.C. area, there is a lot of restaurants. You know, it's funny, you go to California, especially Southern California, you know, it's like going back to Iran, you know. You see every two stores are Iranians, you know. They have from, you know, the restaurant to dry cleaners to video store to bookstore. And so a lot of it is here, you know, whatever, you know, spices or pastries that, you know, I recall, you know, liking it as a childhood, it can be bought here in the United States. So, you know, food, you know, yeah, we make a lot of Persian food because, you know, it's such a wild diversity of food that, you know, you don't get tired of, you know, that, you know, you can always try something new. We also make, you know, typical food that is consumed here, you know, fried chicken and roast beef, things like that. And as far as missing any food specifically, not really, because you have to realize also as you get older, your taste will change. What I used to like as a child, probably if I taste them now, I would say, yuck, what was that, you know? So that's part of growing process. But it didn't taste good then, it tastes good now. And, you know, we make a lot of Persian food here also.
Yeah. Do you have difficulty finding any ingredients in Bowling Green? Or?
No, you know, everything, you know, you can find at Kroger that will, you know, they have everything at Kroger that you need to make Persian food because they are not that really that spicy or they don't use too many, you know, complicated or expensive, you know, spices like they use in Indian cuisine. So, you know, you can find them in most stores here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your daughters and your sons learning how to cook these meals as well?
No, as a matter of fact, my oldest daughter, you know, likes Persian food. You know, middle one and younger one, they say they hate Persian food. I guess part of the fact is they are used to hamburger, cheeseburger, and all these other stuff that, you know, it's hard, you know, you go to school, you eat at cafeteria, you know, and you go to friends' home, eat the similar thing, then it's, you know, hard to develop a taste for it. But again, it's individual. As I said, my oldest one likes, you know, but my other two kids, they hate it, so.
What are some of the main dishes that you make?
Most dishes, Iranian dishes, they have rice as one of the main, you know, ingredients, similar to Chinese. There is rice with different sauces that it goes over the rice. And they use chicken, beef, fish, you know, I mean everything except pork. They would not use pork because of the religious, you know, belief, you know, just similar to Jews. You know, they don't believe in eating pork. So you don't find any pork in Indian, in Persian cuisine.
All right. Well, with the idea that this interview will go into the archives for future generations to possibly listen to. Do you have any stories or ideas or things that you'd like to add to the tape for future generations?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that we need to do, we need to spend more time with our children. I think one of the problems we are facing with this generation, with guns at the school, shooting, I think is combination of lack of time spent with the children, you know, the type of programming that our children see every day on television or they see through the internet, I think people, they should sit and say enough is enough, because, you know, we are gradually desensitizing our kids to torture, to violence. So they are getting used to it. They see it every day on television that, you know, to them, it really doesn't have any meaning. You know, seeing people dead, you know, it becomes to them something like, you know, something like is no big deal. We lose the human value here. We need to teach our children to respect others. We need to teach our children that, you know, we have no right to take somebody's life regardless of what their opinions are. We need to develop the attitude of tolerance for others. We need to teach the concept of God, not brand of religion. Teaching them, you know, after all, God didn't create us to fight like cats and dogs, saying, I'm better, you are worse, I'm going to heaven, you're going to hell, or vice versa. We need to teach each other to main understanding, the Ten Commandments, you know, and to teach them to have loyalty to the parents, respect older people, respect animals, respect environment, you know. And once we teach that, and also we incorporate that in our television program, incorporate that in our value system, in our school, once we start doing that, we will see changes. And I hope we will get to that realization soon, because I can look back, I remember many years ago when in television you couldn't even show the umbilicus, and now almost you can see anything on television. And I look back and I say, what has happened in past 25 years? You know, why all of a sudden in 25 years the value has gone down? It's because as the parents, majority of the parents are too busy parenting. You know, they are media giants, they are building movies left and right, and nobody is there to say, hey, you know, if you make this type of movie, we are not going to go see it. You know, our parents, they get these movies from Hollywood Video, Blockbuster, bring and encourage the kids to watch them. You know, and that's not right, because by doing that, you will have the decay of the moral value. And I hope we will go back to basic and encourage people to spend more time, encourage people to spend more time not only with their parents, with their neighbors, but also in their community, do volunteer work, to realize maybe they are better socioeconomic, you know, financially, but that doesn't mean they are any better than somebody lives in projects.
Okay. One last question related to language. When did you first acquire English skills?
Well, in Iran, I went to private elementary school and private high school. But since I had no idea that someday I would end up here, I never took it seriously. So I almost tried to study bare minimum to get by with English. And therefore, you know, when I came to United States, you know, my vocabulary, you know, was maybe total of, I knew maybe 20 words, yes, no, and things of that nature. So I had to learn quick. And the best way was to mingle with people and try to learn and spend a lot of time. I remember there were times that reading one page would take me like 3.5-4 hours, because I had the dictionary in front of me. And I would look at the word, and then I would find the meaning, and then I would look at the meaning. It had 10 different meanings to it. And then I would go ahead and finish the sentence. When I tried to put them together, it didn't make any sense. So I had to look there to see which one of those, you know, 3, 4, 10, whatever meaning would apply towards that sentence. So it was difficult, you know, going to school, and then, you know, having the teacher to come and give a lecture and then expect you to study a chapter, and then I would go to my apartment and then I would look at the paper, and it was like 30 pages, and one page would take me 4 hours to finish it. But the thing was, because I continue repeating it, pretty much I noticed, I would spend maybe 3 hours for one page, then 2 hours for one page. And then over time it became to the point of maybe it was like one or two words I had to look up. And still to this day the speed is not there, because I think once you get to the age of 18, 19, you can, in most cases it's hard to change the accent. And at the same time, it's hard to change, the speed, because you still, are in the handicapped position compared to the person that they were raised here. I know with my kids, I help them with the study, and a lot of the time there is a word that they don't know the meaning of it, and I'll tell them this is what it means, but you give them a page and give me a page, they will be done at no time, and I'm still, looking. So, it's difficult. You can never master it to the same level that you did with your mother tongue.
So do you still speak Farsi?
I speak Farsi, and I speak Turkish also. I speak Farsi and Turkish fluently, and of course English is the third language I have learned.
So do your children know some Farsi?
My oldest one, she speaks very well. She's bilingual. But the second and third daughters, they understand some of the words, but not as good as my oldest one.
And does your wife speak as well?
Not, she knows a few words. I mean, she can, for example, sit and greet someone comes to home, or ask them what they like to drink, or, and she can understand a lot of stuff, but as far as speaking, she has difficulties. But nevertheless, she can communicate with someone and get by with what she knows.
So a lot of the relatives in the area, when you get together, there's two languages being spoken.
Yes, depending on, with my brothers I speak Farsi, unless, if they are, Farsi speaking people, then we speak English. But it's tough if you learn to speak to someone, Farsi, all of a sudden to change it to something is not as easy. So, it's funny, I don't remember even now a lot of Farsi words. Sometimes, I want to say something in Farsi, and I can't remember. It's easier for me to use the English word versus, using Farsi. I guess with practice, if you do more, you would tend to retain it and remember it. But now that I'm past 40, it's getting difficult to recall the words that I haven't used for a long, long time.
Is it important to you that your children understand your mother language?
I think it's important to learn any language is very important. Anytime you speak different language, you are another person. I remember when I became naturalized citizen, one of during the naturalization ceremony, the judge was saying, one of the things that it made this country to be the greatest country is the melting pot of other people. And he said, because now you have become United States citizen, don't forget your motherland. Encourage your children, your custom. Encourage your language, because with that diversity, we maintain our greatness. And to this day, I believe that judge was right. So it doesn't matter, if you have a mother or father that is, from different country. Even if they are parents that they are American, second, third, fourth, fifth generation, whatever, it's important for them to encourage the kids to learn another language, being either German, French, Spanish. Anytime you learn another language, it opens the door for you to understand another race.
Thank you very much.
You are very welcome. I enjoyed this.
I did too.